Welcome to Enclave on Air. I'm your host today, Jax DiEugenio. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Daniel Spratt, MD, about key updates to the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines for prostate cancer, including how advances in molecular imaging, evolving systemic therapy options, and the integration of next-generation antigen deprivation therapy are reshaping treatment recommendations across localized, recurrent, and advanced disease settings.
It's been a real privilege to share the NCCN guidelines, and we've made a lot of updates regarding the systemic therapy utilization and recommendations across the guidelines. So I think, you know, first, and if we start with localized prostate cancer, I think there's increased recognition that previously we kind of recommended all patients with what we call unfavorable intermediate risk disease receive short-term hormone therapy. I think that we're rapidly realizing that the prognosis of this disease state is increasingly favorable given advances in molecular imaging, staging. And so I think that now it's really a personalized use of hormone therapy based upon, you know, patient-specific factors, age, comorbidities, as well as the overall prognosis for the patient. I think that we've also, with the introduction of a GnRH antagonist, which previously there was one called Degarelix, now there's an oral form called Relugolix. This now has another form of androgen deprivation therapy that is recommended alongside the traditional GnRH agonist, like leuprolide, to be used in any real disease state, pretty much. I think there's a lot of attractiveness when used as a finite course for patients with, let's say, receiving short-term or long-term hormone therapy. I think there's been some other expansions regarding the use of, for example, based on the ARANOTE trial, darolutamide is now introduced into the metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer section without the use of docetaxel, as while does not yet have the follow-up and quite as strong of evidence as some of the other agents with the trials reported earlier, it is now listed there as a category 2B recommendation. And then one of the biggest changes, the systemic therapy section, is really in the metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer section, really trying to provide much clearer guidance to providers and to patients regarding really how to think about, now that we have different molecularly targeted strategies, let's say PARP inhibition, different criteria such as PSMA-positive disease for lutetium PSMA, oligometastatic or oligoprogressive disease for metastasis-directed radiotherapy, predominant bony metastatic disease such as, you know, radium, and as well as many of the traditional ARPIs and chemotherapy regimens. Relugolix, as I mentioned, is this novel oral GnRH antagonist, and originally got approved based on the HERO randomized trial where it compared it for 48 weeks, so almost a year, versus leuprolide. It actually showed Relugolix had superior kind of sustained, suppressed castrate testosterone. But as we've known for years, and with GnRH antagonists, they have a much faster testosterone suppression as well as a faster T recovery. But there's a lot of kind of real world unknowns about whenever you have a new therapy, because obviously in a randomized trial, there's a lot more compliance and other interventions to make sure patients are receiving the therapy appropriately. So I'm fortunate with a great group of people to help lead the OPTICS study. And it's just under a 1,000 patient prospective real world data registry of patients using Relugolix in the real world. And so it's for patients, they don't have to be on it indefinitely, but they need to be on, I believe, at least 6 months of planned therapy. So it can be in localized, recurrent, metastatic, castrate-resistant disease. Very importantly, it can be in combination with different systemic therapy agents. So it could be used, and it has been used with, whether that's different androgen receptor pathway inhibitors or other therapies. In addition, quite a lot of patients actually are received it concurrently or adjuvantly with radiotherapy in the different settings. And so this registry is going to provide, you know, some very powerful granular data about treatment compliance, because it's an oral therapy, reasons for discontinuation. We'll have some data on testosterone recovery and kinetics in the real world setting, and different patient and provider factors into sort of the why they chose relegolix. And so I think we already have some early data, kind of the first 6 months that we've been presenting, and we'll continue to update throughout 2026. And really excited for this, you know, to continue follow up, so we really have more and more powerful data beyond just the randomized data to really show the utility. And I would say so far that the safety and efficacy of this therapy.
That leads perfectly into my next question, which is about the safety profile of relegolix. So what do you want clinicians to really understand about that?
Yeah, so I think any form of androgen deprivation therapy, right, at its core is lowering testosterone. And so I think by lowering testosterone, you're going to have a series of side effects that I think is just pretty much unavoidable. I mean, there may be methods to minimize or mitigate some of them. But I would say the vast majority of sort of the side effects of androgen deprivation therapy will be similar, whether it's an agonist or antagonist, at least while you're on it for that core duration. I think some of the big differences that I think are very clear and irrefutable is, you know, the time to testosterone suppression. You know, it's a few days with relegolix versus weeks with a typical GnRH agonist like leuprolide. The clinical relevance of this is highly debatable, but I think that for patients, there are certain patients you definitely want that testosterone to be suppressed quicker. I think the even bigger impact is actually on the testosterone recovery side, and this is probably an area that's underappreciated. We know, and we've published as well as other groups, that with, let's say, 18 months of leuprolide or other GnRH agonists, it may take you another 18 months or longer to even recover your testosterone. So you're talking about 3 years total of potentially suppressed or below normal testosterone levels. And, you know, after long-term hormone therapy, studies indicate 30 to 40% of men never actually ever, even out to 10 years, recover to normal testosterone levels. You know, we're still learning with drugs like relegolix what that will be. But what we're seeing is that, let's say after, like in the HEROES trial, after almost a year, 48 weeks of relegolix, just within 90 days, over half of men returned into the normal testosterone ranges. So it's just a wildly different testosterone kinetic pattern. And I think that, you know, when you have low testosterone, there's a reason why many men who are hypogonadal now across America are receiving testosterone replacement therapy, whether that's for fatigue, libido, weight gain, you know, bone health. There's a number of things. And so we're investigating further what are some of the major differences between these agents. One of the areas people have studied the most, while I don't think it's always the most critical, but it is an area of controversy, is a number of studies, including one very recently, has shown that relegolix, or I really should say the class of GnRH antagonists, more specifically, seem to result in fewer major adverse cardiovascular events, or people call them MACE events. There's, again, some discordant data. So I would say quite a bit. There's been some meta-analyses that are probably trending towards potentially fewer MACE events with the GnRH antagonists. But it's an area that I would say is inconclusive and needs further study. But I think, if anything, it's favoring GnRH antagonists like relegolix. But that is only, I think, one of the potential benefits of the therapy.
Within the scope of your own practice, how have you seen ADT use really impact patient quality of life?
Yeah, I think one of the main drivers of quality of life for patients is impacted by the use of androgen deprivation therapy. You know, sometimes I tell patients, I call it the 20-20 rule, meaning that about 20% of guys, amazingly, have actually very few, if any, side effects from hormone therapy. You know, their mood is okay, their energy is okay, they have minimal hot flashes. Some men actually still retain some libido. But on the flip side, I'd say there's about 20% of guys that really have a tough time. Weight gain, different metabolic changes, depression. They really struggle being on the therapy. And kind of the middle 60%, you know, they know they're on it. It's an annoyance. They can get through it. But it impacts their quality of life to variable degrees. So, you know, I think we are looking constantly for ways to minimize when safe and appropriate the use of hormone therapy, given we increasingly over time are recognizing the side effect profile, especially, I would say, of GnRH agonists, where they potentially may never recover their testosterone or have chronic T suppression.
Absolutely. It's a really important message. So thank you for that. So what about financial toxicity? Is there anything else you'd like to add about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, any therapy we give, right, there is a cost to it. And I think some of that cost is just from the therapy itself. There's also the cost of the downstream consequences, and whether that's side effects or morbidity of the therapy, or let's say if you don't give the therapy, if the tumor comes back, and what those costs may be. I think sometimes some aspects of what I described are easy to quantify. Some are more difficult. You know, what is the cost of, let's say, if your life is shortened by a year? I mean, we can model this, but I think to each individual, that will mean something different. You know, one of the things that we're appreciating, you know, with long-term hormone therapy, work out of the United Kingdom has showed that it could be 20-30+% of guys are developing fractures from being on long-term hormone therapy. You know, there's no question there's a quality of life impact to that. There's a cost to that, let alone the different metabolic effects. So we do need to be very conscious of the difference in cost and financial toxicity. Normally, newer agents will typically cost more money than older agents. That's pretty common. And so you really need to be thinking about, you know, when is it, let's say, appropriate to, let's say, put patient on a GnRH agonist. And if you're hopefully preventing some of these longer term side effects by having a shorter duration of testosterone suppression, maybe it's worth it. But it's definitely something to be mindful of.
And I think that leads well into my next point, which is really about the importance of collaboration with a multidisciplinary team. So what would you like to add about collaborating with pharmacists, nurse practitioners, and sort of all the members that help manage patients within the context of this care?
Yeah, the multidisciplinary team is vital. I mean, I'd say across oncology, but in prostate cancer, it is absolutely essential. This is not something that a solo, let's say, urologist or radiation oncologist or even medical oncologist should be doing on their own. This is simply because the complexity of it and the nuance of all the care that these patients can receive really requires a multidisciplinary effort. This is expanding to, as you mentioned, advanced practice providers or APPs. These can be PAs or nurse practitioners. If you look nationally, it's about, you know, depending on the study, yeah, it's probably 1 in 3 and rising of providers in the U.S. now are APPs. Now, that statistic will be different based on what specialty and domain of medicine, but there is absolutely clearly a role and need for well-trained APPs, whether that's to help with survivorship care, so after treatment, to make sure all of them, not simply their PSA levels, is being managed appropriately. You know, their blood sugar levels, if they have diabetes, blood pressure levels, mental health. So I think APPs often have the time to give even more than some physicians do, as well as they can often be a great way to integrate, let's say, the opinions between, let's say, a urologist and a radiation oncologist, and make sure there's medication compliance, be involved in, let's say, genetic testing or ensure this is happening. So, and then, of course, pharmacists and other members of the team, including radiologists and pathologists, each of these, I think, play a vital role. And I would just really encourage patients to make sure they're who they see is represented either physically on site by multi-specialty care, or that they have abilities to get these opinions from multiple people virtually.
But what does the future look like? I know we talked about a lot here, and we talked about obviously that, you know, really important prospective analysis, which we'll sort of read out in the next couple of years. But, you know, what does the future look like for ADT and prostate cancer management? And do you ever think that the field will sort of maybe move on, perhaps past this class of agents?
Yeah, I think that probably the most heavily investigated and invested in area to target in prostate cancer is the androgen receptor. So whether that's blockade of the androgen receptor, now newer agents to degrade it, but at its core, you know, what we call it hormone therapy or androgen deprivation therapy, is I think going to remain part of the management at some level of prostate cancer. But what I do think is a few things are happening and will continue to happen. Like the first is we have and others have developed predictive biomarkers that have undergone recent testing and validation, and these will continue to really identify which patients molecularly or biologically do not benefit or benefit very minimally from hormone therapy. It is very clear that there's probably a localized and recurrent prostate cancer. It's probably at least half or more of men do not benefit from hormone therapy. And we need to be able to confidently identify these molecularly or with biomarkers or tools. So I think that's one way to minimize unnecessary exposure. I think the second way is that we are increasingly developing other agents that, you know, hormone therapy is at its core often what we call cytostatic. It's putting the cancer to sleep. Arresting it from growing. You know, the PSA will typically respond well and lower, at least for some period of time, but it by itself does not cure patients. And so you need a cytotoxic therapy. And so in localized prostate cancer, you know, for example, we have trials ongoing where we use very precise high dose radiation. We call it stereotactic body radiation therapy or SBRT to the prostate. We're combining it with different systemic agents without any hormone therapy. So an example of one is called the Starlet trial. It's using a lutetium PSMA radioligand in combination with SBRT to try to actually kill any microscopic cells as well as the external beam radiation to the prostate. I think there'll be other therapies. There's different bispecific T-cell engagers. Again, and a multitude of therapies that are probably going to be combined predominantly with radiation therapy, given you do need something that can give a high enough dose to kill the visible disease. But we do need something because we can't target invisible disease. We're not going to give external radiation to the whole body. And so I think these combination approaches are going to be a fantastic way to minimize or at least postpone the use of hormone therapy until it's needed. And I think finally, is the duration of hormone therapy really does matter. Being on very long-term hormone therapy, as I said, 18 to 36 months can take years, many years to recover testosterone if you ever do. And so one area of investigation is saying, well, why don't we combine androgen deprivation therapy with a more potent form, such as an androgen receptor pathway inhibitor, and shorten that overall duration. So instead of 18 months, maybe we just need 6 months if we use a more potent form of this. Men usually recover the testosterone better, and this may have this a similar oncologic outcomes and hopefully will improve quality of life. So I think these are strategies that both recognize the importance of the androgen receptor, but to really personalize the use of hormone therapy when necessary. And this is a very promising time, probably the most promising time so far in history. I hope I can say this every year going forward, but there is so many developments across the diagnostics, the therapeutics, the survivorship care in prostate cancer, really, really trying to de-escalate unnecessary care, intensify the patients we think will benefit, and use biomarkers and tools to really try to personalize treatment for each patient. So it's an exciting time for patients and for providers, of course.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at Enclave. On Facebook, like us on Enclave and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn.
like today's episode of OncVibe On Air, please also consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you can get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thank you again for listening to this episode of OncVibe On Air.